Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and I really like what CWB Chicago is doing, and we certainly want to participate and amplify their good work. CWB Chicago, this outlet we've referenced a lot over the last few years. Basically, they cover the police scanner and they newsify what comes over the scanner. CWB Chicago declaring this week Electronic Monitoring Appreciation Week. All this week, CWB Chicago will have stories about wonderful things people have allegedly done while they were supposedly on home confinement.
Yeah, they said we should all participate by putting a white ribbon around one of our ankles and then just cut it off. That's how you can help. Yeah. And read one of their stories every day this week. Yeah, again, about convicted felons who go out and commit more crimes.
Well, you want to do some signaling on it, too, because you need something to post on social media to show everybody how committed you are to this cause.
Right.
Here's one of the stories. And as we've talked about, we don't have any interest in this city at the policymaking level in doing anything to reduce the violence on the streets. We talked about that at length yesterday with John Cantanzaro from FOP. So all we can do is tell stories. And maybe at some point in the indeterminate future, there'll be enough people in Chicago who decide they don't want to live in neighborhoods that are shooting galleries anymore. I don't know. Here's one for in honor of Electronic Monitoring Appreciation Week.
We laugh because we can't cry, but yes, who is it?
A 7-time convicted felon who was supposed to be on electronic monitoring for burglary and possessing a stolen motor vehicle was arrested in my neighborhood, Streeterville, this week with a stolen motor vehicle while possessing burglary tools.
Now, how did he learn how to do that?
Anthony Moore walked out of his house on September 30th, left his cut-off ankle monitor behind because he wanted to steal a car and apparently burglarize some other places. And he got pulled over when a maintenance worker at 400 North McClure called 911 about a theft in progress.
Oh, okay.
7-time convicted felon on electronic monitoring, but not for long, because apparently he has the tools to relieve himself of that monitoring device. So that's one in celebration of Electronic Monitoring Week.
And since we missed Monday, we've got another one. On electronic monitoring for 2 gun cases, a man is charged with having 5 more after pulling a mini AK-47 outside of Cook County Jail. This little gem comes to you from 19-year-old Charles Monroe. He told a jail inmate that he thought he heard someone banging on a jail window, so he's going to shoot the gun into the air. He didn't fire the weapon, though, so he offered to come back and shoot it another day. And that's when they picked him up outside of the jail with an AK-47. He had electronic monitoring on as well.
Yeah, he was on electronic monitoring for illegal possession of a machine gun.
Yeah, machine gun. Sorry, I didn't mean. So yeah. Should we call him Machine Gun Charles?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Machine Gun Monroe, that has a certain alliterative ring to it. I like it. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. And now this these stories that CWB Chicago is sharing with us come on the heels of a conversation we've had off and on over the last year. As last year, I think the number was around 5 dozen individuals who were on electronic monitoring for killing or having attempted to kill somebody, and while they were on electronic monitoring, killed or attempted to kill somebody. That happened 5 dozen times last calendar year. And yesterday, Triple Threat had anything to say about safety, public safety, the peace or lack thereof on the streets?
No, she didn't, and she doesn't care. 2,367 Chicago police officers have not gotten vaccinated, and she doesn't care. She said it's not a public safety issue. But you know what? Since COVID is, what, 0.6% right now, and I know you don't like the positivity rate in numbers, this isn't about safety and health. This is simply about control and power.
We're not doing mass firings today, which is what I think a lot of folks have been propagating. That's not going to happen.
Hey, Dan, it's going to be a slow roll.
The rules are the rules, and the police have to follow them, as does the fire department, the same as any other city employee.
I don't understand wait, we're not doing a mass firings. That's what people have been propagating. We're the one that said if you don't get vaccinated, then you go on no pay status. So how are people propagating this idea? You said this is the law, this is the rule, this is the mandate, and so why? So you're saying we shouldn't take you at your word?
No, she's just saying that it's not going to be a mass firing today because I tweeted out, you tweeted it out, John Canzera tweeted it out, people tweeted it out on social media that 2,000, you know, more than 2,000 police officers are going to be fired.
Well, eligible to be fired.
Yeah, they could be.
The progression that she uses is a separate conversation, but they're all eligible to be fired under her mandate.
Right, but she just said it's going to be a slow roll. So she thinks that we mischaracterize what's really going on.
First of all, regardless, so whether you do 30 or 50 or 75 at a time, or you do 2,800 in one fell swoop, the interesting part for the public is how does this relate to our safety? And so that's the question she should answer. She does this all the time. And of course, the lobotomized Chicago political press corps lets her get away with it. What are we talking about? You know, how we're reporting on what you're doing. Tell us how what you're doing relates to the interests of your constituents, the residents of the city. That's the issue.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Joe Hoffman Estate on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. You know, did you guys let this leak out about the white ribbon? I was thinking that maybe the mayor was not wearing white socks during the parade. It was all ribbons. Did you ever think of that?
Thanks for the call, Joe. She was wearing white socks,
yeah,
though, with her kilt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Was there any discussion, speaking of which, of her treatment at the Southside Irish Parade, where apparently she tried to climb up on the float for the Carpenters Union and they wouldn't let her on?
Once again, Dan, the media got it wrong. Here's her response. This is what really happened, and she wants everyone to know what happened at the Southside Irish Parade.
Uh-huh. And I marched with two different unions. I was initially with the Carpenters, and then I finished out the parade with the roofers. I didn't hear any racial slurs. There was certainly nothing thrown at me. I hope that you're not going to propagate that because I didn't experience any of that. I left part of the parade where I was back with the Carpenters, took a little cart and moved up to the front of the parade with the roofers.
But what would it be other than a little cart?
No, I mean, look.
People said there were items thrown even.
No, I didn't see any of that. I didn't see any of that. And I certainly didn't experience any of that.
No, that was
the Southside
Irish
Parade.
They were throwing that
people
stuff at Pritzker,
enjoy themselves and start enjoying themselves sometimes very early.
Yeah, thank,
so there
thank
were
you for explaining
people
how the Southside Irish Parade works.
Didn't
we appreciate
experience
that.
Any of the things
so,
that you
but
said.
The bottom line is, let me just try to understand. So what you're saying is you marched in the parade and you were being moved around like a hot potato. Like right. The Carpenters, you roofers, you take her.
Hey, local plumbers 101. Nah, we're not touching her. Yeah, she went from the Carpenters to the roofers. But the problem was, is that, yeah, Pritzker was in front, and she was so tiny, the people that I spoke to that were at the parade said they didn't see her at first. She was wearing a leisure jumpsuit type of white outfit. It was kind of goofy. Did you see what she was wearing, Dan?
I just saw the kilt.
That was the day before. But what she wore at the Southside Irish Parade.
Oh, woo! Leisure suit.
And so she was behind Pritzker, and there was so much jeering going on that security had to do something. She had to move, or Pritzker had to move. That's what I heard.
So was she dressed up like Elvis? What do you mean, like a
leisure suit?
I'll
show you.
Yeah.
It's hard to describe. Almost like pajamas.
Huh. Decided to give the Pesci wear a day off?
I got to get you one of these for your roast. It's fetching.
Chris on the Dan Ryan.
Yeah, you know what we should do in regards to the ankle monitoring? We should replace the ankle monitoring with a skip-go game. Remember that where you put it on your ankle and you have to hop over it?
Oh, yeah.
That should keep them occupied enough. You should keep them occupied enough where they can't commit a crime, because you'll hear that thing as they come up upon you and try to steal stuff from you. That's just my suggestion. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Chris.
All right. I have a great video to show you. I'll tweet this out because you can see Pritzker walking, then she's hiding behind him. It's really goofy. He's not going to protect her.
Kent in Lincoln Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. Yeah, but they got elected, Pritzker and Lightfoot and all these other leftist Democrats on the mask mandate and, you know, the vaccine issue. And that's all I got. That's all I got left. You know, and the crime has gotten to a point. And if I didn't have my son that's in seventh grade at a school right by where I live, I would move at this point. So, you know, I got to believe that most people that can move in the city of Chicago probably would at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Kent. Or they're, you know, slow rolling their exit strategy the way that Lightfoot is slow rolling her termination strategy with police. By the way, this as sort of a heads up, if you will, to Triple Threat, the Four Tool Mayor, and other, you know, penised people. Five ways COVID can harm your penis. A new study finds a bug infects your manhood. I'm going to tweet this at Triple Threat. Make sure she's aware of the fertility issues, damage to blood vessels and blood clots, long-lasting erections.
Is that a problem, folks?
Well, I don't know. That's up to Amy. I don't know how she feels about that. The other way, ED, and also something that I know would concern Triple Threat, shrinkage.
Oh, yeah.
Penile shrinking.
Yeah.
And you can't
It's a real thing now, right?
Well, you can't hold the title if you don't measure up.
She did get COVID, too, after she was double vaxxed and boosted and wearing masks and sometimes two masks.
All right, so next press conference.
That's today. You want me to ask her what?
I want you to ask her, how big was it before you got COVID and perhaps suffered shrinkage?
Okay. It's actually pretty simple.
Get vaccinated, guys.
Do it for your penis.
Trust us. We're penis doctors.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and
intersection.
Arrogance and ignorance. Arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance.
Intersection.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, on this installment of Sports and Politics. The plight of Brittany Griner, if, like most of America, you have very little knowledge of the WNBA.
Hey, Mike Scott is in our presence.
I know.
Okay?
I know Mike Scott.
He's the
biggest
fan ever of the WNBA.
He is a great benefactor of women's basketball, I understand. But I'm just saying what is true.
Okay.
Brittany Griner, she's probably one of the more high-profile female basketball players. You remember her even from her days at Baylor, because she's like 6'9", she can dunk, she looks like the Predator, you know, from the movies. She does.
Okay.
And would I make...
In a nice way, right?
No, not in a nice way. She just looks like the Predator. I don't know if you think the Predator is attractive. That's fine. But would I make comments about the way men look? Yes, I would. I do all the time.
Yes, you do.
Yeah. So, all right. So, even-handed. Brittany Griner arrested in Russia because she had marijuana on her. And that's a no-no. And we only found out that she was being detained in Russia like within the last week, even though this happened the beginning of February. She's been in absentia, including on social media, which is why apparently some people started to ask questions. Thankfully, one of them was finally her wife. They've had a little bit of a tumultuous relationship. They were both arrested for domestic violence.
Oh, well, at least, you know.
On each other.
On each other?
Yeah.
All right, well, at least there's no favoritism. They just arrested them both at the same time.
Yeah, that was a few years ago. Well, hopefully things are better. She posted a picture of her and Griner on Instagram. I understand many of you have grown to love BG. That's Brittany Griner.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That Buffalo Grove.
Over the years and have concerns and want details, please honor our privacy as we continue to work on getting my wife home safely. Honor our privacy. What, you don't want public pressure on Putin and the Russians to release her? Maybe things aren't going so well. I don't know. Honor our privacy. It's a weird statement to me. Jemele Hill is a barely literate former ESPN anchor. Remember we were talking about how these ghastly ESPN shows that are unwatchable? Jemele Hill was unwatchable. Now she's almost unreadable at The Atlantic, but for some reason they give her a column over there. She writes about Brittany Griner's plight. It's especially acute because she's a black queer woman being held by authorities in a country that's hostile towards LGBTQ people. Yeah, it's hostile to a lot of categories there, Jemele, the Putin regime, you may have noticed. Griner's here's the crux of our argument and what we should focus on. Griner's decision to play basketball in a country that suppresses personal freedoms is a matter of simple economics. Many WNBA stars work in other countries during the WNBA's offseason because doing so is more lucrative than playing in the U.S. Griner is reportedly earning more than $1 million to play for her Russian team in Ekaterinburg, which, is, by the way, is owned by an oligarch who's close to Putin. But I digress, Jemele. In the WNBA, her base salary with some team named the Mercury was $221,000.
How much was it? Sorry.
$221,000.
That's a lot of money there. $1 million in Russia? Oof.
Well, I mean, you got a oligarch who wants to win championships, and so he, you know, overpays.
Okay. And it's the Phoenix Mercury, just so you know. I want you to grow in your knowledge of the WNBA.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Jemele Hill goes on to bitch about how unfair female athletes are being treated here. Russia wouldn't be a tantalizing option for America's best women's basketball players if they could earn more at home and be treated with the same professional respect as NBA players. It is damning that teams in oppressive countries such as Russia and China place a higher value on players such as Griner than the teams in her own country do. The NBA, which founded the WNBA, shares some of the blame for creating an environment where WNBA players who want to maximize their earning potential must play overseas for a significant part of the year.
Well, a lot of men play overseas, too. I mean,
not for the NBA
right,
and then another team, usually.
Just they people play over, that they wanna play, be in the
yeah,
NBA.
They play overseas because they can't make it in the NBA, at least, you know, initially or subsequent to their time in the NBA. It is a little different. It's very different, but for a lot of good reasons. Putting aside the criminal allegations against Griner, her case, at the very least, should create enormous scrutiny around how female athletes are valued in the United States. This is a necessary wake-up call for the WNBA. The league should treat its players better than a team in a hostile country does. What do you think of Jemele Hill's argument? Do we undervalue the Brittany Griners of the world? Are they underpaid, under-respected, underappreciated? Should we do better so that Brittany Griner can just stay in Phoenix all year round and not have to jet off to Ekaterinburg to play half the year? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
I think she's getting paid what it depends on, how many fans are at the stands. You know, not a lot of people are swarming to go to WNBA games, and if the events aren't sold out, you can't make more than $221,000, which I think that's a very generous salary.
The NBA again, Hill writes, shares some of the blame for creating an environment where WNBA players who want to maximize their earning potential must play overseas for a significant part of the year. Just a point of order: the WNBA wouldn't exist without the NBA at all.
Right? They subsidize the WNBA and their salaries too, right?
And now they're sharing blame for creating an environment where WNBA players have to play overseas.
Do they
get credit for giving them an environment where they can play and make money at all in this country?
And also, why are we taking the focus off of Brittany Griner? She knows, she should know, when you live in a foreign country, what are the rules of that country? And if it is illegal to transport marijuana, why in the God's name would it be in her bag? Unless it was planted. I mean, I'm just saying,
I'm highly suspicious that it was planted. I would not be surprised if Brittany Griner
gets stoned.
Gets high. It was like in a vape cartridge, right?
Right. It was vape.
Yeah.
But so just don't do it.
Well, I get it, but
I know this is a separate issue, but whatever. We always take focus on, maybe it's her fault that she did this, because she shouldn't have been going through the airport and have that in her bag. It's an illegal substance in Russia.
Well, I know, but I don't want to go whole, like Midnight Express here. Okay. I mean, focus on Jemele Hill's argument. Also, this statement should create enormous scrutiny around how female athletes are valued in the United States. Really? Jemele, what do you think about Leah Thomas? If you want to talk about how female athletes are valued, are you just talking about Brittany Griner because she is black? You want to talk about all female athletes? What about all those Division I female swimmers going up against Leah Thomas, starting in the Ivy League? A lot of them, you may have heard, don't feel particularly valued. Feel like they're, the Washington Generals in a rigged system. Should they have any consideration or no? Because it's all identity politics all the time with Jemele Hill and her ilk, isn't it? Peng Shui, did Jemele Hill write about Peng Shui, the Chinese tennis player, and her captivity in China?
Trotted her out a few times with the IOC president. Oh, look, she's fine. And then brought her back in.
Yeah, I mean, like a hostage situation.
Yeah, exactly.
We don't really have a full understanding of what's happening with her either. But at least the Women's Tennis Association stood up for her, and they had the courage that not too many D.C. press corps journalists had to criticize the Chinese Communist government. Yeah. Not being valued, really. By the way,
what's her prison
back in the day?
Yeah.
You know, before these leagues gained so much in popularity and before the salaries exploded because of TV contracts and merchandising and so forth. You know, it was not unusual in the early days of these professional sports leagues for the male professional athletes to have jobs in the off season. Talk to any old timers who played in the early days of pre-NFL, AFL. Talk to the guys that played the ABA, before it consolidated with the NBA. And the beginnings, the WNBA hasn't been around that long. And there's been other women's sports leagues that have been tried and failed. Again, the only reason it exists is because of this subsidy. I'm just tired of hearing welfare recipients complain about the size of their checks. The entitlement mentality. The same thing, by the way, during with March Madness starting today.
Today, yeah. Did you get your bracket in, by the way?
Not yet, but I will.
Oh, I'm sure it'll be perfect.
I already know who you have. Iowa's winning everything.
No, I have Arizona winning everything.
No,
but go on.
That's a bad pick.
And Providence is going to lose to South Dakota State.
I think Iowa actually has a good chance to lose in the first round to Richmond.
Oh, of course they do, because they're just coming off their big Big Ten championship.
What?
Winning's getting old.
Yeah.
They're tired anyway.
But I digress. No, so March Madness, though.
Yeah.
Have you seen this commercial? Something about the one of the best buzzer beaters in tournament play in NCAA history, and you probably have never seen it because it was one of the women's college teams, and women get only 10% of the coverage that men get. Spare me, Title IX.
Because it's not that exciting. Right. I mean, I play basketball for years, and I've coached it. It's not as exciting as men's basketball.
Now,
there are some fifth grade girls' games that are so exciting, yes.
Oh, I have no doubt.
I mean,
yeah, I'm sure.
They'd be rating blockbusters if they put it on ESPN, too.
Yeah, I'm sure it recalls the run and reps of the Tarkania area. Yeah. But the Title IX welfare recipients subsidized by the revenue producing sports, meaning men's football and men's basketball. And you're going to, the coverage, because people aren't interested. I'm sorry. You know, this is what you should be interested in. Well, okay, well, I'm not. That's obsession with equity is just an equality of outcome.
On the jerseys of the Iowa Hawkeyes. Oh my God.
No, that's equality.
Equality, excuse me.
But they don't but what they're really saying is equity.
Exactly.
Because they don't even understand it. They think they're synonyms, and they're actually antonyms, as I've said many times. It's just an extension of this pernicious identity politics, but we're going to be lectured about the coverage and the salaries and respecting women in sports. I mean, it is Jemele Hill and these identitarians who have no respect for women in sports, or much or less anybody else who doesn't agree with them. Greg Jefferson Parker, Chicago's Morning
News. Hey, good morning, guys. You know, it's all identity politics all the time. What, $220,000 a year? She works, what, 5 months to make that, and is whining about having to go to Russia? You know, she can go to any country she wants and leaves this horrible place called the United States anytime she wants. That's the freedom that we give her. But, I mean, this stuff never ends. I saw Smollett's brother yesterday whining that people are calling him up and threatening him. And it's, you know, all the gay racism. I mean, it never ends. You know, 90%, I'm sure, of your listeners don't make $220,000 a year. And we're all dealing with it and making it work. If she doesn't like it, you know, she can go get a job collecting garbage or something. You know, with the city of Phoenix. I'm sure if it's anything like Chicago, she'll make another six figures.
A lot of money.
Thanks,
in garbage.
Greg. Well, no, your point is well taken. $221,000. A lot of people actually are able to live on that amount of money.
Well, I know it's going to be difficult for it, but that's only for 5 months of work.
Well, and it's her choice. She sees an opportunity to make $1 million, and she wants to go to Russia. Then go ahead.
Heck,
fine, great.
I would too, but just know what the rules are in the country.
But also, go back to Jemele Hill. This mentality. She shouldn't have to go to Russia to make $1 million. She should make it here. She's entitled to make it here.
She's not entitled.
Nobody is. Nobody's entitled to make anything.
Nope.
Mike and Hammond.
Hey, thanks for taking a call, guys. Yeah, when the average high school basketball team can beat the WNBA team, just like years ago when they complained about the women's U.S. soccer team not getting paid right, when the average boys' soccer team can beat them. Where's the $220,000 a year for the high school kids?
Right. Thanks.
Oh, and today's
thanks
equal
call,
payday,
Mike.
By the way.
Yeah, I mean they just settled. The soccer federation just settled with the women over this, you know, pay discrimination suit, which is total nonsense.
Don't fill the stands. It's just not the same.
Led by that identitarian crank, Megan Rapinoe. You know, and all the, you know, the breathless signaling by corporate America and other athletes and solidarity and Jemele Hill and, you know, they deserve this and they deserve that. It's an exciting brand of soccer. Well, fine. If you think so, great. Guess what? A lot of people don't. The market dictates. The market tells you how exciting it is or not. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I deserve this and I deserve that. As my favorite quote, one of my favorite quotes of all time from Milton Friedman, who deserves what? We are lucky we don't get what we deserve. Darren in Crown Point.
Hi. If the WNBA is so concerned and so principled, shouldn't they detach themselves from the NBA?
Yeah, right. Well, no, they're entitled to be subsidized by the NBA, and they're entitled to tell the NBA at what level they deserve to be subsidized, at least according to Jemele Hill. I'm not necessarily putting this on Griner because she's not saying this, but Jemele Hill is, and she represents sort of the leftist sports press corps that we were talking about yesterday. Michael Wilbon railing against Kevin Durant because he doesn't understand something that is not understandable, why Kyrie Irving can be in the arena, but he can't be on the court when the Brooklyn Nets play. And Wilbon goes off because he has to, you know, wave the COVIDian flag as a good leftist journalist who's trying to project credibility and standing as an important thinker in this space when she's not. And neither is Jemele Hill. But these outlets turn over their brands to people like those two and so many others, the full cast of characters. Pete, Milwaukee.
Good morning. Say, Amy, you mentioned she should know the rules of the country she's going to. Listen, every airport on the face of the earth has that you can't carry a controlled substance through the airport. What it boils down is you can't cure stupid. and that's what she had on her going through an airport.
Craig, Mount Greenwood.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy, and thank you for taking my call. I'm trying to figure out what the heck it's with Ukraine and Russia taking, paying all this money, the big bucks to our losers and everything like that, like Hunter Biden, the same thing. He's a big gas tycoon in Ukraine or Russia or something like that. But he's really like a crackhead and everything like that. And this one here with the pot and everything, and can't, I guess, make it over here.
Well, then, no, she's making it over here. She just isn't making enough of it over here. That's
why she's forced to go to a communist country.
She's making it, but yeah. Money. Thanks, Craig. But what about that? I mean, she's working for a Russian oligarch. Is she a stooge of Putin, like anybody else who has any tangential relation, or even less than that, has any criticism of Biden administration policy with respect to the Russian invasion of Ukraine? But I digress. We'll get to that geopolitical matter later.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
And Amy, more and more of these missives online, from a few weeks back, but still relevant. Ryan Staley is a teacher, was. After over 15 years as an educator, I left my teaching job. As a third generation teacher, I grew up around highly competent educators who dedicated their careers to the growth and development of thousands of kids. I found myself on this path because I value the great reward of watching my students and athletes struggle, learn, grow, and succeed. Unfortunately, over the last couple of years, it has become more and more difficult to educate and develop students. From fights happening often and students overtly disrespectful to the adults to constant battles over cell phone use and obsessive gaming on the computers, life in the contemporary middle school classroom has become morally and emotionally draining. The bottom line, too many students were coming through the door with deficiencies in the skills, knowledge, and attitudes necessary to be successful. We're talking about sixth graders. Sixth graders often had no phonics skills and couldn't read. Sophomores in high school who were not capable of writing more than a paragraph response for an essay. And college freshmen who could not handle basic algebra. Our schools are failing the long-term development of students through the implementation of a neo-Marxian, neo-racist agenda. Schools are now pushing kids as young as kindergartners to become agents of change with the underlying focus of making them all social justice activists. Schools and staff have bought into the idea that teaching is political and that the goal or purpose of an education is to bring about equity and liberation. I can no longer be part of a system that so readily abhors the United States, the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitution. I no longer want to play a part in the indoctrination of students into an ideology that is destructive, harmful, and unjust. I will no longer sit idly by as collectivism and activism are the primary drivers for why we educate our youth. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Love to hear from teachers in response to what Ryan Staley had to say. 15-year educator, third-generation teacher, and this is what he sees starting apparently at the middle school level where he was teaching. Does that sound familiar? Whether you're leaving or not, does that sound familiar? Is that what you're seeing? Is this legitimate criticism of what's happening in pre-K through 12 education generally, both in terms of what is being done and what is being accomplished? In other words, what the curriculum and the angle of instruction is and how the students are producing or, as Ryan Staley describes, not producing. no phonics skills. Sophomores in high school not capable of writing more than a paragraph response for an essay. College freshmen who can't handle basic algebra.
That's why parents have to read their kids' homework to see if they're, you know, if they're literate, to see if they can construct a sentence or an essay. I grab my kids' homework all the time and read it.
Is that what's happening?
Well, what did they expect? I mean, phonics skills? I mean, we've covered kids' mouths and kept them locked out of school for 2 years.
Yeah, I think this was happening before the pandemic.
But the pandemic exacerbated it.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it.
Well, I know that the evidence is pretty clear about the retardation of the intellectual and social, emotional development of these kids. Yeah, no question.
And yesterday was supposed to be, you know, mask-free, mask-optional.
It's about more than masks, though.
Okay.
Pre-pandemic, exacerbated, still happening. Post-masking.
So Ryan's just leaving? Ryan Stately?
He's done, so he says.
Just giving up?
Wisconsin teachers instructed to hide students' gender identities from parents.
Yeah, that was in Eau Claire, right?
Teachers at a school district in Eau Claire... being instructed to hide their students' changing gender identities from parents on the grounds that parents are not entitled to know. And that is knowledge that must be earned.
Oh.
Parents have to earn the right to access the knowledge about their kids' gender identities. You don't just get that information. You got to earn it.
You got to work for it. Uh-huh.
The training sessions held in late February, hosted by, of course, the DAI staffers at the University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire.
Yes, there you go.
One of the slides in the training session reads, remember, parents are not entitled to know their kids' identities. That knowledge must be earned. Teachers are often straddling this complex situation. Our priority is supporting the students. Chris Jorgensen is the director of the UW Eau Claire's Gender and Sexuality Research Center and said, quote, teachers are often put in terrible positions, caught between parents and their students, but much like we wouldn't act as stand-ins for abuse in other circumstances, we cannot let parents' rejection of their children guide teachers' reactions and actions in response to the instruction.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Well, if your son or daughter wants to change their name legally, the parent needs to know because the parent has to go to court with the child, mother and father, if both are around, have to go.
Yeah, I mean, the legal name change is, you know,
that's
way down
begins.
The road. No, it's actually way down the road. It doesn't begin. It begins with today I'm a girl. Today I'm Danielle. Today my pronouns are her and she or Z or they or them, or I'm non-binary or whatever. And this is how you're going to treat me in school. And this is how I'm going to be educated. And this is how people will socialize with me. And shh, don't tell the parents.
Can I ask you a quick question? When I get emails from male CPS employees, they say him, her, no, not him, her, him, them, they. So I don't understand what that means. Can you help me out, Dan? Or is it just a bunch of gobbledygook? He, him, it says he, him, them, there. What does that mean?
I don't even them, know. There? That person's a place now, too? I mean, I don't know. But this is, you know, this is just Pandora's box, whatever. All the Hariblaze. There are no boundaries. There are no lines. There's no truth. There's feeling. Just feeling. So is this happening or not? Are these stories that we report from California to the Cheese State, they're just one-offs? Anomalies? What our friend Ryan Stately wrote at his Substack, that's a unique experience. He's got it wrong in terms of what's happening in K-12 education. Well, again, we talked about this at some length yesterday when we talked to the filmmaker for Whose Children Are They? Which, if you didn't see in theaters yesterday, it should be moving to the streaming services. And we've been talking about these stories for a long time. And usually it's the elite schools that are the instigators. So, for example, the Dalton School in Manhattan, where their dean resigned the end of last year after controversy about the curriculum. The Dalton School is K through 12. Some of the parents saying every class this year at the Dalton School in New York, this is, you know, one of those $60,000 a year schools, K through 12. Every class this year in an obsessive focus on race identity, racist cop, reenactments in science, decentering whiteness in art class, learning about white supremacy and sexuality in health class. Wildly inappropriate, many of these classes feel more akin to a Zoom corporate sensitivity training than to Dalton's intellectually engaging curriculum. Well, that intellectually engaging curriculum is gone. That's the point. And by the way, when it comes to the sexualization of children, which we talked a little bit about, particularly against the backdrop of the prohibition on gender identity, sexualization of children, education, in quotation marks, in Florida, what the critics say is the Don't Say Gay bill, which of course it doesn't say.
No, it doesn't say.
And it's now being picked up by Republicans in Georgia, too, and being explained, thankfully, by Ron DeSantis, wherever he goes. So back at Dalton School, here's a video that started to get some parents' attention over at the Dalton School in Manhattan. Manhattan now, not exactly Trump country, to borrow a Smollettism.
Too soon, Dan.
Scoop and Friends. Scoop and Friends.
Scoop and Friends.
Meet Scoop and Friends. It's a cartoon video for first graders at the Dalton School in New York that teaches first graders.
You have it.
Nice. About masturbation.
Ew.
Pass it, Squeaks.
Whoa, watch it. You almost hit me in the pee-pee.
What's so funny, you two?
He said pee-pee.
Do you notice that when you say pee-pee, you giggle, but when you say penis, you say it in a serious voice?
I never noticed that before.
Some children and adults feel uncomfortable when they talk about their private parts, so they make up cute or funny names for them.
What's one for a girl's private parts?
Vajayjay!
But what does Scoops mean when he says vajayjay?
He means vulva.
That's right, Kayla. It's important to use the proper words for our private parts.
Why?
Because our private parts are just as amazing as our hearts, lungs, brains, or any other of our amazing body parts.
But our hearts pump blood, our lungs breathe, and our brains think.
All our private parts do is pee!
That's not entirely true, Scoops. It is true that a person pees or urinates through a hole called the urethra in the penis.
Does everyone have a urethra?
They do. It can be harder to see, but girls have a tiny hole in the front of the vulva where urine comes out from their urethra. Urination is actually very important. It helps us get rid of waste, stuff our body doesn't need.
Hey, how come my penis gets big sometimes and points up in the air?
That's called an erection.
Sometimes I touch my penis because it feels good.
Sometimes when I'm in my bath or when Mom puts me to bed, I like to touch my vulva too.
You have a clitoris there, Kayla, that probably feels good to touch the same way Keith's penis feels good when he touches it. But have you ever noticed that older kids and grown-ups don't touch their private parts in public?
They don't?
That's right, Keith.
Unless they're rats.
It's okay to touch yourself and see how different body parts feel, but it's best to only do it in private.
Well, if private parts are so special, why do you cover them up?
Because they are private, silly.
That's right, Kayla. Because they are private.
Hey, Squeaks, pass it.
Wait. Okay, I'm ready.
This is first graders?
At the Dalton School, $60,000 a year. So...
gross.
Are we over the target here on this show with all the evidence that we presented for years and continue to present from actual practitioners, parents who've uncovered these PowerPoint presentations, this instruction, these videos? Yeah, I think we are. Michael in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I had a quick comment, and I wanted your reaction. The school in Wisconsin, I'm sure they taught a lot of us not to make assumptions, but weren't they making an assumption that by communicating with the parents would not accept the fact that their children are transgender? And then the second comment is how are they supposed to earn the trust if they don't know?
Yeah, right. Thanks for the call, Michael. Right. Well, you're right. They are making those assumptions, and it's not unusual. This is, we heard from audio from a conference in California. In conservative areas, how do you deal with parents? You know, conservative areas. How do you deal with parents when it comes to these identity issues? And so the default position is obfuscation. And I assume they'd say, well, we want to vet and make sure, earn that knowledge. That phrase, earn that knowledge. We want to make sure the parent is going to share our position before we share the information.
But it's none of their business. I mean, who's governing our kids? We should be.
Well, thus the movie.
Unless they're using this instruction time to convince them to change genders. That's possible.
Who is?
Teachers. All this propaganda that they're convincing kids through thinking, you know, the kids are vulnerable at that time and they'll do anything their teacher's saying. If a teacher's like, well, are you sure, Janie, you don't feel like Jimmy? Are you sure you're not, you know, that's a possibility.
There's research that was spiked from Brown University about the increase in young girls identifying as boys. And the aspect of that increase that was the result of a social contagion, in other words, peer pressure. But of course, that was spiked because, you know, that makes it sound like it's political and societal rather than some sort of awakening to living one's truth, which is how it's presented. Tina and Joliet.
Hi, guys. Hey, forgive me. I'm on the stair stepper. I'm a little out of breath. I went and saw the movie last night with a couple of my girlfriends, and one of the things I think that most of us didn't realize is that this started so much longer than we are aware. And the teachers unions are behind it completely. They have they did play clips of the cartoons that they're using to indoctrinate the kids into over sexualize them. And they're beyond disturbing. They're being shown to really, really small children, kindergarten. And it's the only word I can use to describe what's happening in our schools is evil. It's pure evil. There is a hyper-focus on gender and sexuality coming from these new grad teachers, and they are determined to get this into every piece of curriculum that our kids are being exposed to. It's really, really awful. I encourage everybody to take the time, find where this movie is being streamed and watch it. They cram a lot into the 2 hours, but it's worth every minute of it. You have to, we have to pull this curtain back, rip this Band-Aid off, and fight this battle, or we are doomed. I think we've already, there's a generation of kids that it's going to take a long time for them to ever recover from what they've been exposed to. I don't even know if they'll come back, but if we don't do it now, I don't know what's going to happen.
Thanks for the call, yeah. Tina. The movie, again, is Whose Children Are They?
Whose Children? Text message. I'm a teacher. Take your kids out of K-12 public schools now. Critical social justice ideology is in every school. Your child is being indoctrinated and not learning. Take your child out now.
Clay Wheeling.
Morning, Dan and Amy. We were like 10 years ago. Like, two guys just want to get married. That was a slippery slope.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, as this 28-year-old male, not confused with his gender, I am getting very close to just saying screw it and moving to the middle of Alaska with my fiance and never having to talk to anybody from modern life again. I mean, this is every day. Somehow I wake up and I go, there's no way they can stop yesterday. And then here it is right in front of you. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Clay. Dave, Wakanda.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. My mother was a Chicago teacher for 35 years, taught reading. And so many kids would come through. They're 14 years old and they're in third grade. They just tap them on the butt, go to fourth grade, go to fifth grade. And if the kid so-called did very well on the test, they would be absolutely ridiculed and belittled by the rest of the class. What do you want to be like, Whitey? And they would shame them for doing well on the test. Now, before you guys were talking about this teacher quitting, I have to say we need people to stand up and stick in there because we need voices like his, and we need people that have the truthful way to be teaching and not just this indoctrination system. That's my thoughts.
Thanks for the call, Dave. Yeah, I hear that position, but the question is K through 12, government K through 12 salvageable? And I mean, there are good public schools, but thinking of from a system perspective, I mean, for example, is Chicago, is that salvageable? No, it's not. It's not salvageable. No, nor are many urban school districts around the country and some suburban ones, too. They're not salvageable. They're institutionally incapable of changing. You're not going to change them from the inside out because you have a couple of teachers stand up. There has to be a mass abdication. More convinced of that than ever. And this is why the school choice movement is taking off, is because more and more people are convinced of that with each passing day, too. And that's a good thing.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Are you going to get the booster? We talked about public sector employees like Chicago police officers, firefighters, still being in the crosshairs because of the city's vax mandate. And one wonders if that will be extended to booster number two or shot number four, depending on how you're scoring.
Yeah, that's what Pfizer came out over the weekend and said, you know, you're going to need that fourth shot, Dan.
Albert Bourla, the CEO of Pfizer on Face the Nation.
Do you think that we will every fall have to prepare ourselves for a booster shot with COVID just like we get a flu shot?
I think so. Many variants are coming, and Omicron was the first one that was able to evade in a skillful way the immune protection that we're giving. But also we know that the duration of the protection doesn't last very long. So what we are trying to do, and we are working very diligently right now, it is to make not only a vaccine that will protect against all variants, including Omicron, but also something that can protect for at least a year.
So you've seen some of that data on a fourth dose, a second booster shot. Mm-hmm. You think it will be necessary?
It is necessary, a fourth boost right now. The protection that you are getting from the third, it is good enough, actually quite good for hospitalizations and deaths. It's not that good against infections, but doesn't last very long. Mm-hmm. But we are just submitting those data to the FDA, and then we will see what the experts also will say outside Pfizer.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Will you comply so long as they continue to mandate the shots?
I had to get the booster in order to keep my job at CPS. Well, not I could have opted out, but then I'd have to subject myself to testing once a week. And I didn't want to do that because I know that there's a lot of false positives out there, and I didn't want to be out 5 days because when you have a short season of boys volleyball, you don't want to be out a week. So I complied, and I feel sick about it. But that's the world that I've chosen to live in. I got to see this out. I have a few more years and then I'm done.
Rebecca Sugar is a philanthropic consultant in New York City. She wrote a piece about her visit to the New York City Center to watch the performance of Prayer for the French Republic. I never checked the theater's website for its COVID policies. Had I looked, I would have known that there was still a mask mandate in place and I wouldn't have bought a ticket. I arrived at the theater 5 minutes before the curtain went up. I was asked to put on my mask. I didn't have one. I threw my mask away the minute New York City mandates were lifted, but the helpful door attendant was happy to hand me one.
Oh, yeah.
I took it. I shouldn't have. I thought about handing it back and turning on my heel, but I didn't. I put it on and rushed to meet my friends. Arriving at my row, I loudly objected to the absurdity of continuing a policy already proven to be ineffective. My friends agreed, as did two strangers seated to their left. I told myself making a public fuss was a substitute for acting on what I believed. I should have left. Instead, I sat down. I seethed at the mask monitors in front of the room who scan the audience for masks that dip below noses. They seemed to love their jobs. I could have stood up, apologized to my friends, and said what I truly felt, that abiding this policy was feeding the monster and that I would not participate. No play was worth my dignity. I could have walked out, but I didn't. It was raining outside. It went upset my friend who'd organized the afternoon. I heard great things about the show, and I was already there, so I stayed. I had refused masks before, foregoing a night at the opera and an entrance into a store. When it was easy, I was all in. But in a moment of decision, when convenience and conviction collided, I chose the former. Shame on me and everyone who feels as I do and acts as I do. We are the reason that mask mandates still exist. The compliance is the reason mask mandates still exist argument that Rebecca Sugar is making can easily be applied to vax mandates as well.
And I am surprised at how many parents are brainwashed thinking that masks in Chicago public schools are going to save them and save their souls and save their children.
What happened to an option of remote learning?
I don't think it's too soon, but it's just my own comfort, because one of them had COVID before.
Oh, my God. And guess what? Your one child that had COVID before is fine and is at school today. I mean, these people, and you said it, you said they're not brainwashed, they're brain dead. And that is so true.
That's a choice they're making. That's a choice that Rebecca Sugar made to stay at that play. The issue is compliance. Is it clear that compliance feeds the beast? Masks, vax passes, 6 feet apart, standing on an idiot circle, wiping down surfaces. Is it all of that performative compliance feeds the beast?
Yeah, this isn't about your health or safety anymore. Now it's about power and control.
So will you comply is the question.
I did, and I feel sick about it.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Something else, too, that Al Borla had to say over the weekend as he's continuing on his book tour. He's got a book out called Moonshot.
How did he have time to write a book during a pandemic?
The great ones make the time. The Andy Cuomo's, the Albert Borla's. Borla on... Amazon Post podcast talking about his initial skepticism about mRNA vaccines.
It was, quote, most counterintuitive to go the mRNA route, and yet you went that route. Explain why.
It was counterintuitive because Pfizer was mastering, or let's say we had very good experience and expertise with multiple technologies that could give a vaccine. Adenoviruses, that some of the other vaccines are. We were very good in doing that. Protein vaccines, we were very good in doing that, and plus many other technologies. mRNA was the technology that we had less experience, only 2 years working on this.
And actually, mRNA was a technology that never delivered a single product until that day. Not vaccine, not any other medicine. So it was very counterintuitive, and I was surprised when they suggested to me that this is the way to go. And I questioned it, and I asked them to justify, how can you say something like that? But they came and they were very, very convinced that this is the right way to go. They felt that the 2 years that of work on mRNA since 2018, together with BioNTech, to develop a flu vaccine, made them believe that the technology is mature and we are at the cusp of delivering a product. So they convinced me. I follow my instinct that they know what they are saying. They're very good. And we made this very difficult decision at that time.
You know, it's interesting about that. And I'm all for the adage that in order to be persuasive, you have to be persuadable. You know, you need to be open-minded. And so Bourla was persuaded by his research experts to go the mRNA route. Okay. Made that very difficult decision, he said. So if it took the CEO of one of the biggest drug companies in the world some time to be persuaded that this was the route to go, you would think there'd be a little bit more consideration by the experts and the TV docs and the policymakers when it comes to explaining to the American public why this is the way to go, rather than put your mask on and get your jabs, which is the approach they took. Just do it because we said so. Do it because we're experts. Do it because we say we're saving lives. Albert Bourla started from skepticism and had to be convinced by his team of researchers. And then that gets translated by the ruling class and their functionaries like Fauci to do it because we said so. And social pressure and, you know, and cynical compensation ploys and the rest of it, rather than putting the American public in the position of Albert Bourla and saying, persuade us. We're going to persuade them. We're going to give them the information. We're going to walk through it. We're going to take questions. We're going to listen to countervailing opinions within the medical community that have expertise in this area as well, and address them publicly. No. Over the top, you shall do it. Lock it down. Put it on. Get it inserted. That was the approach. But it wasn't the approach that Bourla used internally at Pfizer. I find that very interesting.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
Mary, Midway.
Oh, hi. I resolved the issue for myself, I'm proud to say, but I'd have to be on that line that scrambles your voice when a person's called to tell you the details. So I'm just going to leave it at that. But what I'm calling to tell you and Amy is I know people that have gym memberships that cost $600, and they've gone in there, and eventually they had to get the jab if they wanted to keep going. I mean, wouldn't you say, hey, give me my $600 back?
Yeah. Well,
a lot of people did. A lot of people stopped going to the gyms. A lot
Thanks
of people
stop
going to restaurants, to movie theaters, to bowling alleys.
Yeah, that's the point. I won't go anywhere. I mean, I remember some places where I couldn't go in that were vax mandate enthusiasts, mask enthusiasts. I'm not going back. Places that I love going to, the Lyric Opera, Shakespeare Theater.
Well, you still have to wear a mask there.
Done.
Negative, provide a negative test or a vaccination pass.
I don't, because I'm not going.
Okay.
And in that, in moments like Rebecca Sugarhead, I'm glad she wrote her story. I appreciate it. And I appreciate her honesty about it, what she wishes she would have done if only more people had this, had the capacity to feel shame for shameful behavior. They don't. Not the COVIDians. But this is her story is very instructive because I'll remember her story if and when I'm put in that moment and say, see ya, don't need to be here. I'll stream it. I'll read the play. You know, I'll watch old versions of it from theaters around the world on YouTube or whatever. compliance feeds the beast. And beast is the appropriate description. Joe on the Southwest side.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Dan, I agree with you 100%. The more we comply, the more this is going to feed the beast, and they are not going to stop. I really personally, you know, I don't know how to myself, I haven't complied, and, you know, you try to tell people, but I think people don't get enough awareness from the counterpoints of what the actual jabs are doing to people to actually get the, you know, again, the correct exposure to make a real
call for money.
Oh, shoot.
Thanks for the call, okay, Joe.
Got to go back to work.
Yeah, he's got another pressing business to attend to. Ralph Rantoul.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, and by the way, the Borla, everything is a bunch of hooey. Because if you actually believed in God we trust, everybody else bring data, then Pfizer wouldn't have tried to hide those thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of data that it took a FOIA to get released. And now that people are combing through it, they're finding, you know, 9 pages of side effects. So here's my theory. I think that eventually they're just trying to get us to the point where we wear a little module like an insulin pump, and you're just required to drive into the government station, shut up, and then they put in the capsule that just feeds into your body. Adam Carolla, the comedian, has a great phrase for this. He calls it crate training. You know, the resistance that you're talking about, Dan, you know, is in, hey, forget about it. You want this? Take it. I'm out of here. Me and my money, we're going someplace else. He says, people like us, old farts, we will push back. This is all geared towards crate training, like the pups. So as the children grow up, they become compliant and obedient like puppies.
Thanks for the call, Ralph. Yeah, crate. I have heard that Carolla-ism on this, and that is a good way to describe it. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Yeah, like Logan's Run, that movie.
Yeah.
With the crate training there. Yeah, but I think it's more like with the pharmaceutical CEOs. It's like, l'état, c'est moi. The old statement by Louis XIV, I am the state.
Right.
They're basically little dictators. That's what they think. But they might also be a little bit worried now. He seemed a little bit, you know, defensive on some of these things in a way over the, perhaps over the actuarial data that shows all those, potentially those excess deaths. I don't know if any of that stuff is true or not, but you see these reports about a lot of excess deaths.
Yeah, thanks for
the shaking in their boots a little bit.
Thanks for the call, Frank. He may also be concerned about the shifting political balance of power in places like D.C. and Republicans taking control of Congress. And I mean, even right now, Rand Paul is advancing amendment to legislation to eliminate Tony Fauci's job so we can't have a dictator medical dictator in chief sort of thing. But you'll still have Biden in the White House. But if you want to look a little bit down the road, if you have Republicans in control of Congress, they can start making life at the congressional level very difficult for some of these drug companies, start beating the drum for perhaps the removal of some of the indemnifications that these drug companies currently enjoy. And, you know, 24 is not that far down the road after November of 22. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. It was just a couple of weeks ago that John Kerry was very concerned about Russia invading Ukraine because, of course, that could take the eye off everybody's eyes off the ball, and that's with respect to climate change.
I'm very concerned about Ukraine because of the people of Ukraine and because of the principles that are at risk.
But mostly
in terms of international law and trying to change boundaries of international law by force. I thought we lived in a world that had said no to that kind of activity. And I hope diplomacy will win. But a massive emissions consequences to the war, but equally importantly, you're going to lose people's focus. You're going to lose certainly big country attention because they will be diverted, and I think it could have a damaging impact. So, you know, I think hopefully President Putin would realize that in the northern part of his country, they used to live on 66% of a nation that was over frozen land. Now it's thawing, and his infrastructure is at risk, and the people of Russia are at risk. And so I hope President Putin will help us to stay on track with respect to what we need to do for the climate.
Yeah.
Don't mind the 2.5 million refugees who lost their homes and loved ones.
Well, yeah.
Focus on the climate change.
He's certainly right. I mean, the main thing to think about with the 800-odd Russian missiles that have impacted Ukrainian buildings and blown people up is the emissions. The emissions from those missiles. You know, but it's nice that John Kerry is still extending that olive branch to Putin to be a partner in climate change because he's a serious person. On the good news front, though, for these eco-terrorists who we assign titles of Russian royalty, ironically, the Green Czar, John Kerry. On the good news front, this has provided the apocalyptic environmental crowd the opportunity to tout getting off of fossil fuels and getting into a Tesla.
The future of transportation is electric.
Gas prices have hit a new record high in America and expected to keep rising.
We need to make sure that it becomes relatively more attractive to have an electric vehicle instead of a gas vehicle.
So you want gas prices to go up and oil prices to go up.
You need it to reflect the true cost of carbon.
Number one, no more subsidies for fossil fuel industry. No more drilling on federal lands. No more drilling, including offshore. No ability for the oil industry to continue to drill, period. Ends.
Record high gas prices, the national average now at $4.29 a gallon, a 60-cent hike in just 1 week.
The president is really focused on making sure that people are not hurt at the pump.
Several around L.A. that are more than $6 a gallon.
If you drive an electric car, this would not be affecting you, clearly.
There's no sound or fume.
How many barrels of oil does the U.S. consume per day?
I don't have that number in front of me.
So how do I know it's actually working?
What is the Granholm plan to increase oil production in America?
Oh, my God. That is hilarious.
Perhaps if you let the market work in this respect, people will feel pain. They'll take a second look at that Ford F-450 gigantoid truck. They'll reconsider a Tesla.
I'm willing to pay $4 a gallon. Hell, I'll pay $15 a gallon. Because I drive a Tesla.
I have a Chevy Bolt. That is my car. I lease a Bolt and I lease solar panels. So I drive on sunshine, girl.
Record-breaking prices at the pump nationwide.
One of my favorite topics, electric school buses.
Electric school buses that have big batteries underneath it.
Yes, we are very excited about electric school buses.
Yeah, some prices are as high as $7 a gallon.
You usually can smell it and you can hear it. You can hear the guzzling sound.
People from rural to suburban to urban communities can all benefit from the gas savings of driving an EV.
Yeah, boy, how about Joe Biden, campaign Joe Biden versus President Joe Biden now? Campaign Joe Biden was eliminate the oil and gas industries, basically. Now it's we're trying to do everything we can to keep the price of the price at the pump down. The guzzling sounds coming from Kamala and Mayor Pete and Jennifer Granholm, the whole team, really quite something to behold, isn't it? For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Bjorn Lundberg, president of the Copenhagen Consensus Center, that's a think tank, author of False Alarm, How Climate Change Panic Costs Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. Bjorn, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan. It's great to be here.
You know, with all this emphasis on electric school buses and everybody buying a Tesla or a Chevy Volt or what have you, I was having a conversation with a former CFO of BorgWarner, which is a huge automotive supplier, as you know, the other day. And he said, you know what's interesting about this whole discussion is the next generation beyond fossil fuel-powered cars wasn't electric battery. It was the hydrogen fuel cell. That's what we were working on. But, of course, when policymakers direct subsidies in a particular direction, then that's where corporate America goes, where the money is, where we're getting help financially to develop and to market and to sell. And so that's where all the, if you pardon the pun, energy went. But it was actually, if you were thinking about long term and something that's a viable and impactful and sensible next generation automobile, whenever it hit those marks, it was actually the hydrogen fuel cell cars powered by hydrogen. And rather than drawing on electricity only for a battery, it produces electricity.
Yeah, so Dan, that's a very good point, and it underscores the fundamental problem of trying to decide what is the future way before we actually can see that in the market. Look, electric cars are great. You know, if you've ever driven a Tesla, it's a fun car to drive.
Yeah.
And for some people, it's a great idea. Now, there's a huge conversation, and I'm not going to be able to tell you who's right, that maybe hydrogen is a better opportunity in the future than electric cars. But the reality is neither of those cars are the best opportunity right now. And we know that because you actually have to bribe people in order to get them to buy a substantial amount of electric cars. Remember in Norway, which is the country that has the most electric cars, it almost sells 80 to 90% of its new cars are electric. That's basically because the government supports it so much that the actual cost is near zero for electric cars. So you basically have to say, do I want to pay almost nothing or do I want to buy a new gasoline car? And not surprisingly, most people will then say, I'll go with nothing. But of course, that's not a way that most countries can afford to get most people to buy their car. Norway is still just at about 10% electric cars, and they're already starting to wonder, can we actually afford this when nobody's paying for the roads, when nobody's paying for anything? You can't subsidize your way to the future. The only way you can do that is by making innovations such that, for instance, electric cars become so cheap, people will want to buy them instead of a gasoline car.
So in the immediacy now, with the more pressing issues of energy prices in the West, your suggestions for Europe and for America, for that matter, for weaning themselves off of Russian oil and gas?
Well, fundamentally, the reason we need Russian gas in Europe is because we've relied so much on solar and wind. What do you then do when the sun isn't shining and the wind is not blowing? You need firm backup power, and that typically comes from gas. If you want to be energy independent, you have to get your own gas or buy it from the U.S. We should learn from the U.S. You've basically gone energy independent by fracking. We should do the same thing. Remember, if we could build our own gas infrastructure in Europe, we wouldn't be dependent on Russian gas. And that, of course, is one of the reasons why Putin has probably been subsidizing quite a bit of the anti-fracking movement in Europe, because he certainly didn't want us to start fracking. He would much rather have us keep spending money on his regime.
But the U.S. is what, 8% of our oil supplies comes from Russia? So that said, the fact that we're, not buying Russian oil, that is not the reason for these gas prices skyrocketing, is it?
Well, it's the point that everybody's very worried, as you've also seen, gas prices has just gone down the last couple of days. Oil prices has just gone down. But it's still very high, and everybody's very worried what's going to happen. The point, though, is if you want to look just a little further out, you need to have that energy independence. The U.S. can expect a lot of its frackers to go back to work and actually produce much more gas and oil, and that will drive down the price. Now, admittedly, you need an administration that don't just say, look, we love you for the next 3 months, and then we're going to dislove you again. You actually need to believe that they will want to keep investing in fracking. But if you have that ability, you can drive down the price. We need to have the same in Europe. And I think in general, what we have learned from this is you can't just keep arguing, oh, renewables is going to fix the whole thing. Renewables can be part of the solution, but fundamentally, as long as we haven't solved storage, we're still in the position where we need to back up whenever the sun is not shining and the wind is not blowing. And You also need to remember sun and wind and electricity in general only makes about a fifth of our total energy use. What are you going to keep for heating? What are you going to do for industrial processes? All these other things, you still need mostly fossil fuels.
And included in the mix, and it's being ramped up in France, is nuclear. Michael Schellenberger, environmentalist, was touting that as well. In this country, the Sierra Club has long been a organization that endorses nuclear as a safe and clean energy source. But, you know, because of, you know, the Chernobyl and the Love Canal in our sort of in the back of our minds, some of the hysteria around nuclear power, you haven't seen nuclear reactors, energy reactors, yep, built in the West very much in recent times. And this seems to be a mistake.
Yes. So absolutely. Again, Dan, we need to separate the two. Existing nuclear power plants are incredibly cheap. Remember, you've already built them, which was the most costly thing. You've also committed to eventually decommissioning them. So while they're running, they're incredibly cheap. So of course you shouldn't dump existing nuclear power plants, as unfortunately Germany has done, as has also been done with Indian Point in New York and Diablo Canyon and California. Having existing nuclear power plants and shutting them down is just dumb. There's an other consideration of whether you should build new nuclear power plants, because unfortunately they're pretty expensive right now. So the new ones that has been built, for instance, in Finland and France and in England, have turned out to be very costly, and that drives up electricity prices way above what most people would be willing to pay. And that's where the promise of more innovation, essentially the new fourth generation nuclear power plants, could be very alluring. So Bill Gates and many others have been investing in these much more modularized and much more industrially produced power plants. They promise very cheap energy. Now, again, there's been a lot of promises in the past that haven't come to pass. So we want to, you know, see this actually happening. But again, we should be investing a lot more in energy R&D. Because if we can deliver clean and cheap and reliable energy in the future, that would be amazing. But we can only do so if we focus on innovation.
When we're looking at right now, again, in real time, with the supply issue with respect to oil, what's your reaction to Elizabeth Warren, Senator from Massachusetts, proposing a windfall profits tax on oil companies? Because I guess she believes that they're withholding production to drive up the price so that they can expand the profits that they make on the oil they do produce.
It's hard to exactly tell why in the first place she would be arguing that they have a windfall. Look, I mean, they've also suffered through some really low prices as well. And the reality, of course, is you are only going to get a lot of oil production if you not only have the prospect of sometimes having to suffer through low prices, but also sometimes actually get the really high prices. Again, we should be focusing a lot more, instead of just making these punitive policies, we should be focusing on making the innovation. I would love to see Elizabeth and others to suggest the U.S. should step up and increase spending on innovation. This should be across the board, certainly on nuclear, also on fusion. You know, this alluring ideal that we could actually recreate the sun in our labs. That would be an amazing opportunity to create energy. We should also be looking at batteries and solar and wind and, you know, storage and second generation biofuels. There are a lot of different opportunities, but common to all of them is right now they're not cost effective. Innovation could make them cost effective, but we need to be realistic. Right now, most of the world is run on fossil fuels, and wishful thinking doesn't make that go away. It is only innovation that can achieve that.
And the left's continuing prosecution of the case for net zero,
Net zero is one of these amazing things. You know, people will talk about that. Biden and many others will say, oh, we should be doing net zero. But nobody tells you what the price is going to be. So I don't know if you saw a month ago, I think McKinsey came out with a new study that showed this would cost $9.2 trillion per year for the next 30 years. Now, remember, we've become pretty inured to talking about trillions of dollars, but that's actually a lot of money. That's 7.5% of the entire global GDP every year for the next 30 years. There's no way we can afford that. That would drive up prices everywhere and also in the U.S. quite dramatically. You know, the net zero cost for every taxpayer in the U.S. could be somewhere between $5,000 and $11,000 per person per year. There's just no way people are going to be willing to pay that. And of course, that's why not only is it a bad idea, but it's also unsustainable. You're basically going to get people to vote out of office the politicians who suggest these kinds of approaches. That's why we're never going to do net zero or any of these other very, very wild policy proposals by forcing people to pay way more than they're willing to. We're only going to do this if we get the innovation such that, for instance, nuclear becomes so cheap, everyone wants to buy it.
He is Bjorn Lundberg, president of the Copenhagen Consensus Center think tank, also the author of False Alarm, How Climate Change Panic Costs Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. Bjorn Lundberg, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Great to talk to you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Insert Democrat Socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House floor for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when you're moving out.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. That's theme music. Means it's time for our weekly confab with Ted Dabrowski, president at WirePoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. Ted, let's begin today just with a quick down and dirty tutorial on gas prices in Chicagoland and Illinois generally. The breakout, so people can be reminded now that they're paying attention to the price at the pump, just how Illinois taxes gas and how Illinois is one of just a handful of states that taxes the tax on gas, I should say.
Yeah, we like to put a tax on the taxes. Good morning, Dan. Good morning.
Layer the taxes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the first thing you have, okay, we all in every state we pay the federal taxes, motor fuel taxes, 18 cents roughly across the country. So we're all equal on that. But after that, Illinois has a motor fuel tax, which used to be 19 cents before Governor Pritzker came on, and he doubled it to 38 cents. So that's the big tax. Then we also have a sales tax on gasoline. So as the price of gasoline goes up, guess what? Your taxes go up. And we don't tax the Illinois motor fuel tax, but we do tax the federal part of the taxes. So we tax the tax. Then you've got in Chicago, you got some additional city taxes. A lot of cities have some additional city taxes. So we end up, when you pile up all those taxes, we end up around 80 cents per gallon in taxation. That is the second most in the country, second only to California.
It's about, in normal times before this recent spike, it still increases, as you're mentioning, the sales tax on the federal portion. About a quarter of what you pay at the pump in Chicago is taxes.
Yeah, and it's phenomenal. We're paying 72 cents more than Missouri per gallon. I mean, think about that. Just per gallon, if you just cross the border, of course, this is on average, so you have to find the right places, but 72 cents less in Missouri, something like 52 cents less in Wisconsin, same thing in Kentucky. I mean, it's a ripoff here. I guess it's the only way I can put it. It's a ripoff. And so why do you see so many people crossing the border to buy their gas? Because you save a ton of money.
Well, but didn't Pritzker freeze the gas tax? Like, so he doubled it first and then froze it?
Yeah, right.
No. Wasn't that his gift to us, like, to show that he cares? Yeah. You know, because I can't remember the last time he filled up his own personal tank with gas because he's got drivers.
Well, remember now, so there was one more component.
For the Southside Irish Parade. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, there's one more component I didn't mention. They also, in that, when they doubled it from 19 to 38 cents, they also said that that motor fuel part will go up with inflation each year. And so there's automatic gas tax hikes each year. That's the one that Pritzker proposes to freeze, which would increase gas prices by 2 to 3 cents in June or July. So he's freezing that one, but that has nothing to do with all the increases and the fact that we pay the second highest taxes in the country.
Speaking of crossing the borders, Allied Vans Zillow study comes out, and we find that 113,000 Illinoisans crossed the borders of the state permanently. They left Illinois, 113,000, the eighth year in a row Illinois has lost population, the only state in the Midwest to lose more than 100,000 in population July of 20 to July of 2021. People just, it's interesting. So many people that are former Illinois residents just don't get how well things are going here.
Yeah, they're missing out on it. No, you know, we hear from people all the time who are out, and you know, it's kind of sad, but they always celebrate. You can go on websites and say, "Hey, I left Illinois. I'm so glad I'm free." And it's sad, right? Because that's not the state that we want. And certainly, you know, if you want people to leave, well, it's because they find an opportunity elsewhere, but not because they're fleeing Illinois. But sadly, every piece of data, everything, you know, like you said, the Allied van lines, the population loss, 114,000 last year. That's number two in the country. We keep losing people faster than everybody else virtually.
Mm-hmm. And also who we're losing and, you know, the not one for one, but who is coming in. I mean, I remember the work you've done previously on this. This is an important point here, which is you're losing top income earners. This was, you know, the people leaving top 20%. The people coming in, it's not disparaging anybody, but you're just losing a lot of economic capacity and wealth creation. The gap used to be the largest in the nation, $20,000 difference in terms of median salary between the people leaving versus the people coming in.
Well, that's precisely right. I mean, you know, it's one thing to lose people. Even if you broke even, you don't want to be trading people that make more money for people that make less, you know, only because your tax base is shrinking. And a lot of times if you're losing your big earners, well, you're losing your entrepreneurs or your investors, people who hire people for other jobs. So this has been the big problem. And you know, Dan, Amy, Wire Points, we went through all the IRS data. You know, they're the ones that know where you moved to, where you moved from, how much money you make, how big your family is. So you can really track, you know, which states are winning people and their money and which states are losing people and their money. And when we went through it, we looked at every age group, you know, the major age group categories. We looked at every major income category. And in every single one, we lost more people on net than we gained from other states. And not only that, then you add in the layer that in the people we did lose made more money than the people we made. You know, it's a formula for disaster, which is why we shrunk. We were only one of three states in the country to shrink in the decade from 2010 to 2020.
So in response to that, they got a good idea down there in Springfield, impose a de facto increase in payroll taxes on employers.
Yeah, so this is the other big thing. You know, one of the things that got blown away when we did all these lockdowns, when Governor Pritzker and other governors across the country locked down their economies, people went unemployed. And so our unemployment insurance fund, which is what the state runs to pay people benefits while they're unemployed, well, it just got blown out of the water. It lost money. And so we ended up in Illinois borrowing $4.5 billion from the federal government. Well, we haven't repaid that back. We're one of nine states not to repay. Most states use their federal COVID aid to repay that. Well, guess what we didn't do? Well, we didn't pay it back, and so we still owe that amount. And there's a big debate about how to repay that debt. We should use the remaining part of the federal COVID aid we got. There's $3.5 billion that Pritzker hasn't used. He should use every penny of that to pay that down, but Others want to put the tax burden on employers, make them pay it back, which, of course, would mean more jobs lost.
And more companies are going to fold, don't you think?
Well, they fold, or they just don't, they stop investing here. They keep doing more in Indiana and other places. I mean, you know, you look at the Indiana unemployment rate right now. It is half of what it is in Illinois. Illinois' unemployment rate is 5%. Indiana's is 2.4%. So, you know, if we had that same unemployment rate, we'd have 160,000 more workers working today in Illinois. Think about it. It's 160,000 jobs. That's massive.
Mm. But again, you're talking about debts, unemployment insurance debt that we have. And I recall the governor's state of the state address where he talked about how he balanced the budget without having to access any of the COVID funds that Illinois received.
Well, sadly, that's one of the big lies in Illinois. We always balance budgets, but we always have more and more debt. And here, you know, here's a perfect example of this. You know, Andy Menar, one of the spokes guys for Pritzker, Governor Pritzker, they're all celebrating balanced budgets and all that. And here you go, $4.5 billion and no plan on how to pay it back. And you know, they won't even use the federal aid. I mean, they should have done that. The state got $8.1 billion in federal aid from the federal government. They should have used every penny of that to pay back this debt, and they didn't. They spent it on other stuff, you know, programs.
Because it's an election year.
That's right. You can see every few days, Governor Pritzker announces some big spending program that he's, you know, $50 million here, $20 million there. And to me, they look a lot like just campaign announcements.
He is Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, wirepoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Things are escalating. Thanks to the Wisconsin National Mustard Museum.
What are they doing?
They posted a sign at the National Mustard Museum just south of Madison there. The Russian mustards have been temporarily removed.
Oh, okay.
They will return once the invasion of Ukraine is over and Russia recognizes and respects the sovereign nation of Ukraine. And not a minute before that happens will those Russian mustards be returned.
Such misguided energy sometimes, don't you think?
Montreal Orchestra cancels Russian piano prodigy due to mob bigotry.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. A Russian piano prodigy who actually has spoken out against Putin dropped from its concert lineup because of anti-Russian sentiment and woke tolerance. Enlightened Montreal. I mean, we've documented all sorts of examples of this, but I think for more general commentary, let's turn it over to one of our favorite satirists on social media, Ryan Long.
Yeah.
It's been a couple of weeks since I transformed into a Ukraine guy, and gotta say that I'm loving my new personality. Will you guys denounce Russia? Oh, you're still telling people to stay at home and get vaccinated?
No, it's cool. I mean, yeah, whatever works for you, dude.
Ukraine for life. Well, you know what I mean, for a couple weeks till we get the next one. This was Putin. I just sort of give him one of these. Maybe one of these. I was a big Palestine guy. I was a big Afghanistan guy. What's going on there now? Yeah, actually, pretty good question. I haven't really checked in on it.
Oh, my God.
Are they still doing the whole being a country thing? Oh, look, it's Putin's home. You either want America to get in there and start mucking things up, or you love Putin and want to marry him and have sex with him. Yeah, I'm pretty binary thinker.
Pretty much.
I'm non-binary and everything else, though. Would the dog be willing to denounce Vladimir Putin?
I don't want to be on TV, but I don't know.
We'll remember that. That's all I'm saying. That will be remembered.
God.
I mean, yeah, in an ideal world, they wouldn't be white, but at least the bad guys are white, you know? I try to look on the bright side. I think we should just be blocking the airspace and then, you know, let the cards fall. You know, if it's war, then it's war. It's not like I'm fighting personally. I'm not like I'm some soldier. I mean, if you ask me, Iraq was probably holding the WMDs for Putin. A little industry secret, but if you move on to a new personality, you never really have to be held accountable for how right or wrong you were about your last thing. Found out this is a Russian microwave, so getting rid of that. I won't eat Russian soup. I refuse to eat Russian vodka. Yeah, I know there's other war stuff happening all over the place, but maybe if they wanted people to care, they should get better at going viral. How many TikTok stars does Yemen have out on the forefront? I just put the old thing out of sight, out of mind, you know? Sort of like Bart Simpson did when he put his guitar in the garage next to his karate outfit in the unicycle. Where's Ukraine? Beside Russia. Where's Russia? In Russia? I asked my stepdad to formally denounce Putin on his social media, and he told me he didn't have social media, so I guess we're not going to be having a family dinner this week. Yeah, I'm one of the first people to start being about Ukraine once the news started talking about it, so if anything, I'm a bandwagon finder. Censorship also just really gives me a boner, so it's nice to have a new avenue to participate on that front. If people want to post the wrong information about the election, COVID, Ukraine, I mean, yeah, they should be reprimanded. Whether they have their channels taken down, or if I had my say, a prison sentence. Cuomo, Fauci, Zelensky. Just a bunch of guys that I would call daddy. All I'm saying is if you're watching this video right now, you better not be Russian or there'll be consequences for you to pay. It's crazy. Some people will say that there's propaganda on both sides when in reality there's only propaganda on one side. Sorry, I get a little emotional when I'm just thinking of how brave the ghost of Kiev was.
How brave the what?
Ghost of Kiev.
Russia should be nuked. Yeah, I was writing stay-at-home raps. I wrote a Putin rap. Putin, you're a doofus. Gonna get these two fists and these boots, bitch, and your tooth's kicked.
Yeah, sounds he's still working on the rap, but you get the commentary. For more on this, pleased to be joined by John Nolte, Breitbart News senior writer. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah. So you suggest in your piece, not satirically, that some of the Republicans who are beating the drums of war, like the Lindsey Grahams of the world, risk derailing Republicans' chances to retake both chambers come November.
This is something I'm a little less worried about than I was when I wrote that piece, because the Republicans seem to have steadied, except for people like Mitt Romney. But when I saw Sean Hannity on Fox News talking about no-fly zones and bombing Russians and trying to blame it on someone else, I got a little worried, because like what the recording you played, the satirist, I mean, you can see this moral panic, this war fever growing throughout the country. And I was very concerned, and I'm still somewhat concerned, it's going to infect the right, because what the left is doing with the war is basically transferring all their zealotry we saw around George Floyd and all the zealotry that then transferred to the coronavirus. And now it's transferred over to this, to Vladimir Putin. And we're seeing the same nonsense instead of being reasonable about it and rational about it and allowing us basically as a country to unite around our disgust at Putin's war crimes. You know, they are pushing us away and making sure we can't unite by doing all this crazy stuff, which is, you know, like the things you mentioned earlier. They're blacklisting these performers. We didn't even do that stuff during the Cold War. And after 20 years of losing wars, the idea that A, we should go into Ukraine, or B, we could do any good in Ukraine is ludicrous. And I can tell you that from everyone I deal with on social media and in the comments and that I talk to, the last thing Republicans and Trump supporters want is any involvement in this war beyond, you know, the financial sanctions. And if the Republicans get the war fever, and like Mitt Romney has just gotten, and thank gosh, you know, he's not really one of us, That would kill our chances, because the last thing people want is to get us involved in another war we can't win.
So Senator Romney thinks we could liberate Ukraine?
Well, he I don't know if he thinks that, but he's talking about, you know, he's flirting with no-fly zones, and Kissinger is talking about that, and that lunatic Lindsey Graham is openly, a United States senator openly trying to prod people in Russia to assassinate Putin. I mean, the guy's got nukes. I mean, forget the fact that we haven't won a war in 40 years. He's got nukes. So I don't know. I don't know what they're thinking. I don't. But it's just nuts because we can't do any good over there. And even if we could do any good, it's not our problem. We need to stay out of it.
Well,
and if that becomes the issue in 2022, it's going to kill. I think we're still going to take over the Congress. But what I see coming, which is a tsunami, a red tsunami, that's actually going to realign our politics. The chance of that is going to diminish greatly.
You know, looking at some of the recent polling, Byron York wrote about this. It's dismal for the Democrats and for Biden. But he points out in the survey that he dissected, they do have a few strengths. And one of them is actually quite depressing. They have an 11-point lead in which party is best able to get the pandemic under control. Now, as York points out, that may or may not be much of an issue come November. But still, the fact that after the last 2 years, they have that margin to their benefit on pandemic policy is really, really disquieting. It sort of goes to this idea that they have perfected in terms of how they play politics. You know, activity can obfuscate results. If we're the most active party, if we're saying the things that we're doing, saving lives, getting this under control, defeating the virus, and so on and so forth, then it doesn't matter that what we're actually doing is ineffectual to counterproductive.
Yeah, the only good news in that, and I saw the article, the piece that you're talking about, the only good news in that is that number has plummeted over the last year. But you're right, it is dispiriting, because what you see is, if you look at the facts, I mean, more people died under Joe Biden, and he had a vaccine, and then died under Donald Trump. So yes, there are things like that just feel counterintuitive, but you're right, I think it is just more activity, more moral preening can sometimes be confused with doing something that helps. And sometimes, you know, there's a big part of the public that just wants to see, quote unquote, something done.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
That's why there's, you know, we're doing yoga for Ukrainian refugees next Tuesday.
Right.
I'm not making this stuff up.
You're doing your part.
I'm doing the down
part
dog.
Of the war
I'm, yeah. It's
yeah,
part of
it's
the war.
Part of the war effort.
So
yeah.
Anything we could do.
Yeah. You're Rosie the Riveter over there. Amy, the yoga enthusiast for Ukraine. I mean,
class I go to, but they've decided to, you know, proceeds, and we'll all go to help Ukrainian refugees.
But that really does go to this larger cultural issue, John, though, of just exactly, you know, the level of intellect and maturity you're dealing with when it comes to wide swaths of the electorate.
It's moral exhibitionism, and it's a form of McCarthyism, where everybody's trying to outdo everyone else to prove their purity. Mm-hmm. So they'll go to the point of ridiculousness, like yoga for Ukraine. I wouldn't send a penny to Ukraine. Does anyone really think that money's going to get there? There's a button on my Facebook page that I can add so people can donate to Ukraine. So, you know, I want Ukraine to humiliate Putin. Don't get me wrong, but I know it's just the grift. It's all grifting, and that money's never going to get there. It's ridiculous, but we are in this phase, and we saw with George Floyd, and we saw with the coronavirus, and now we see it here, where there's this McCarthyism going on. You're either on my side or you're a witch, and I'm going to prove my purity by proving how impure you are because you won't do yoga for Ukraine. It's just nuts, and hopefully it's not going to catch on. And the good news, the polling I've seen recently says the public doesn't want any part of Ukraine. So the war fever that's going on, and it's not just happening on the left, it's also happening in the left-wing media. You know, the way that they're portraying it, the what's happening to Ukraine, which is awful. But you can just see what they're doing, repeating, trying to generate emotional blackmail. You can see it in the artists, the way that they're approaching it, in Hollywood and whatnot. And of course, all of it is generated by War Incorporated. The munitions people, the weapons people, the FBI, the CIA, the Pentagon, you know, they love this stuff. But thankfully, it's not working. It worked in Iraq. It worked on me, to my eternal shame. But I don't see it working in the polls. And I think that has a lot to do with new media just stepping back and going, wait a minute. We need to think about this. We just got out of a 20-year war we lost against cave-dwelling goat herders. I mean, do you guys really want to go up against the Russians? Mm-hmm. So I think that's the good news in this, is that the public is not falling for it.
Well, there's something else too. Another survey that the GOP would do well to pay attention to, and this the Edelman Trust Barometer, which is in its 20th year, surveying sort of global attitudes about how things are going for people in terms of their own economic security interests. 65% of the worldwide informed public, as described by the survey, that's 25 to 65 university educated in the top 25% of household incomes. So a distinct minority of the world population. 65% of the worldwide informed public says they trust their institutions. Only 51% of the mass public said the same. So you barely have a majority of 83% of the total global population saying they trust these institutions. And that is also something on the decline. It's this chasm that's described by this survey of trust in institutions between essentially the elite and the deplorables. And what Trump identified in 2016 persists to 2022.
Yeah, and that distrust, that's so important. It's so vital to distrust and be skeptical of institutions. And you can see why there's that chasm. You know, the elites, the institutions serve them. The elites want power, and they get power through the institutions. The elites love an orderly society. Institutions can do that. The rest of us understand that true freedom is messy, and that the more messy it is, the more that says about how free we are. So that chasm is there, but obviously we outnumber them, and hopefully a politician, you know, maybe Trump or DeSantis can take advantage of that in 2024. They seem to be the two politicians who truly get it. I just cannot imagine the wipeout of Mitt Romney would face if he ran again in this environment.
Mm. John Nolte, Breitbart News senior writer. John, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, guys. Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Can we do like a little 300 level session on identity politics? I think we can. I think we can dial this up a notch. I mean, it's good prep work for me, too, for my little confab tonight. I'm, as I mentioned, I'm interviewing Josh Mitchell, who's a professor of political theory at Georgetown University, for Nutrier Neighbors in Wilmette tonight. Should be a nice affair. NutrierNeighbors.org. I think there may be a ticket or two left. He's written a book, America Awakening, about identity politics. He recently gave a talk at Catholic University on the subject as well. And I think he makes some really interesting points in terms of trying to get your head around this, both in terms of the historical run-up to where we are today, as well as an understanding of where we are today and where this thing is going, sort of the choice before us. His characterization of the race war that identity politics is fomenting is really interesting. We've sort of described it, but we haven't encapsulated it the way he does. And I think this really hits the mark.
Identity politics has promulgated a race war in America that few dare acknowledge. This cold race war is not between black and white, but between white and white and between black and black, between the wrong kind of white man and the right kind of white man, between Sylvia Bennett Stone, who is the wrong kind of black woman, and, say, Pulitzer-winning prize winner Hannah Nicole Jones, who is the right kind.
Yeah, it's not between white and black. It's between white and white and black and black. And Latino and Latino, and Asian and Asian, to continue on, but you get the point. Really interesting. And he's right, because how do we discuss this? We talk about these Chardonnay Antifa types in places like River Forest and the North Shore and Hinsdale. And we're talking about overeducated but under-enlightened white people. We're talking about white leftists, and particularly women, but not limited to women. Also, their male impersonators, the male impersonators that they married, p-hats. But it's white versus white. The wrong kind of white man, the right kind of white man. The wrong kind of white man, Donald Trump. The right kind of white man, Joe Biden. The wrong kind of black woman, as you just heard him give the example of, Sylvia Bennett Stone, we've had on the show. She's the head of Black Mothers United, talking about policing the streets of urban neighborhoods where a preponderance of the violence occurs and where a preponderance of the victims, actually a supermajority of the victims, are young black men and these mothers who've lost sons to street violence getting together, black moms, Black Mothers United, versus Nicole Hannah Jones, the right kind of black woman. She's, New York Times-backed revisionist historian trying to rewrite American history through the prism of identity, racial identity politics. That's the real war going on. And I haven't heard it put so succinctly, but I think that's it. There's another aspect to this. The end of competence, Mitchell talks about. And of course, we see this play out. What are we talking about with our institutions? We're just talking about this with John Nolte. The mistrust of our institutions. Why mistrust? Because we're jealous that so many of the heads of these institutions are richer than us and went to Ivy League schools and we didn't and got advanced degrees. And it's just envy. No. We see them in charge of institutions that have much power and they're exercising that power in an incompetent fashion. And this dynamic that Mitchell talks about, Professor Mitchell, the end of competence versus the apprenticeship knowledge for mediating institutions that we get if we put the work in. What are mediating institutions? De Tocqueville's Platoons of Democracy, we're talking about, as well as the bigger institutions, schools, churches, professional associations, philanthropic or fraternal organizations. The end of competence and substituting shortcuts for the hard work of apprenticeship. And he gives a very interesting example of the what's happened over the last 50 years. The Apollo mission for sending men to the moon and the Artemis project.
The Apollo program put two men on the moon in July 1969. From scribbles on a notepad to landing the LEM on the Sea of Tranquility and returning three astronauts safely to Earth, the most advanced feat of engineering in human history, required 8 years to accomplish. The Saturn V rocket that took them to the moon was 363 feet tall. It weighed 6 million pounds. It had over 1 million parts. At NASA, the engineers were in charge. Sputnik will prompt that sort of thing. A half century later, the engineers are not in charge. There is no urgent need to push the envelope of national competence. Why should there be? Living in a post-war world will prompt that sort of thinking. The current innocent signaling administrators of NASA plan to spend $30 billion on the Artemis program so that a woman can step off the ladder of some mid-21st century LEM and signal by her very appearance to a shrinking national audience of childless families and of women who live alone with cats that the future is female.
Meow, meow.
Exactly right. I mean, but that's what it is.
Yeah.
That what the approach that was taken to put men on the moon in 69, ultimately, 8-year project, versus the $35 billion Artemis program now, which is about equity, not engineering, not exploration, not advancing human civilization. It's the sentimental barbarism that punctuates all of these institutions. He also had commentary on what he terms the FANG elect class, which is an interesting description. So FANG, of course, for you stock pickers, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, or Alphabet, Netflix, Google, whatever. The FANG elect class. And the difference between supplements and substitutes. An important distinction that's also been lost, but we were reminded of by the Freedom Convoy in Canada, by the People's Convoy in America.
Do not Amazon Prime packages dutifully arrive to service my every need and whim? Do not the dark people of DoorDash, appropriately masked for my protection, present me with the meals I order on my smartphone? Amidst in the aftermath of COVID, a social chasm in America and elsewhere has widened and been starkly clarified. The FANG elect class have inoculated themselves against filth, poison, and death, while the reprobate that service them have done so without complaint. No, we were not in all this together. Reacting to the recent Freedom Convoy, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau laid bare the inner sentiments of the FANG elect class. Those across the social divide who bring them their stuff are Nazis and racists. That is, toxins that the elect have the right and obligation to purge and financially ruin. Yet now suddenly the unthinkable has become thinkable. The politics of innocence and transgression, built on this new American segregation that seemed until recently unassailable, could collapse at any moment if those cisgender reprobates who bring them their goods hit the brakes and stop delivering things. Marcuse once despaired that Marxism could never take hold if capitalism kept producing the goods. The identity politics awakening will falter when trucks refuse to deliver them. The digital world in which the FANG elect class thinks it lives is a supplement to the analog world of things, not a substitute for it. The Freedom Convoy is a stark reminder of this invariant fact of human life. Supplements cannot become substitutes.
They don't have as much power as they think they have, or even some of us think they have. You know what short circuits their power? You just heard it from Josh Mitchell, and we've seen the examples. Noncompliance. Noncompliance. We talked about it earlier in the program when it comes to COVID mandates. And it's the same conversation here when it comes to identity politics and the expressions of identity politics. When the people who live in the world of things stop producing and delivering those things to the people who provide the supplements, the people who provide the supplements get in a bit of a twist because they got a bit of a problem. And this doesn't mean that they can't bring power to bear because of the resources that we have chosen to confer to them, as he was describing with your Amazon packages and your DoorDash meals. But there are limits to it. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I'll post Mitchell's full talk, and we're going to get deeper into it tonight in Wilmette. But, I mean, this is, if you really want to put some thought into this and gain an enhanced understanding of what has happened and what we're facing, I think Josh Mitchell provides sort of a great framework for consideration. And the consideration is individualize. What are you going to do? What are you going to do when and where it manifests itself in your life? Which is a question we've been asking for some time, and people are answering it differently. And perhaps people who answered it one way a couple of years ago are thinking about answering it differently now because of how entrenched it's become in all of these institutions. These institutions that are riddled with the politics of innocence and transgression. The absolution of the elites and the indictment, the assignment of guilt to the deplorables, to the people who live in the worlds of things, production and distribution. This is really, really good stuff. Something else, too, on the topic that's worth checking out is a George Will piece, How America Became a Nation of the Woke and Weary Walking on Eggshells. And this is not the starting point, but this was a watershed moment, and it's underappreciated. He talks about an incident in 1991 at Penn State University where a female professor, English professor, demanded that a reproduction of Francisco Goya's naked maha, which had been hanging in the classroom for years, be removed from her classroom because, you know, the vision of a naked woman made her uncomfortable. She thought it was discriminatory or harassing in some
misogynistic
in some way. Yeah. In her book, and we're working on getting her on the show, Gail Harriet, University. She's on next week Wednesday, I understand. Okay, great. Gail Harriet will have her on next week Wednesday. Gail Harriet, University of San Diego law school professor, The Roots of Wokeness. The Title VII damage remedies that were enacted in the Civil Rights Act of 1991, adding to existing law provision for compensatory and punitive damages for emotional distress, open the floodgates for this sort of litigation and compensation for essentially microaggressions. Harriet writes, after this legislation, the dramatic increase in the number of harassment charges filed and in the monetary stakes. In the final quarter of 91, the number of EEOC harassment charges increased 71% over the same period in 1990. Strengthening identity politics while weakening support for free expression concerning race or sex, because employers could be liable for a hostile environment created by employees. The change regarding remedial measures made it pay for employers to start vigilantly policing their employees' speech, that is. And because there were generously remedies available for sort of ill-defined wrongs, you had management cracking down, and then this became the culture on campus. And it also gave birth to this whole dye industry that we talk about that's now everywhere. All of these consultants, the race hustling and identitarian hustling consultants to supplement
moneymaker.
Well, to supplement HR departments and corporations and the whole departments and six-figure paid positions at universities and the administration. The evolving, George Will writes, the evolving law of harassment and hostile environment propped attitudinal changes congruent with three emerging cultural ideas. That it is wholesome to define one's identity with reference to race, sex, or ethnicity. That it should make one acutely alert to affronts, even if micro. And that there's an entitlement to pass through life without emotional distress occasioned by abraded sensitivities. He goes on, time was America's aspiration was for preoccupations with racial, sexual, and ethnic differences to lose political saliency and to recede as relations between the sexes and races became more relaxed. Instead, over the last 25 years, those preoccupations have intensified as government policy has encouraged them and embraced discrimination on the basis of them and provided compensation on the basis of them, I would add. So how this policy change projected forward the identitarian left's cultural designs, and then the two became self-reinforcing over the last 2.5 decades. Watershed moment. And now we find ourselves where in the place that Josh Mitchell described, race wars, but internally, because it's between identitarians and non-identitarians, essentially. It's between those who look at somebody's non-behavioral characteristics, and that's where judgments are to be made, and those who look strictly at their behavior and say, that is how I make my judgments. Mark in the Western suburbs.
Yeah, Dan, I heard you comment about this professor and the comment about competence. And it, in the about a decade ago, I was in the Dominican Republic, and they had to suffer through errant power outages or rampant power outages. And what I'm thinking is that our country right now, we're living on the high of the competence of prior generations. But as we embrace more and more wokeism, and I'm not saying I embrace it, it's disgusting to me, you know, sooner or later, we're going to suffer that same repercussion, because as competence gives way to wokeism, we lose the ability to rise as a society, and we'll end up in the, you know, in that sort of a predicament.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Yeah, there's another aspect to this, of course, which is, you know, competence won't be our salvation either, but the judgment and the standard setting, placing importance on apprenticeship knowledge within these institutions as opposed to identity, is a good start, but it's not the end, because it still comes down to where you see your salvation residing. And the question that's asked all the time on this show, do you believe in God or do you believe your God? And the identitarians say, I'm my own God. And those who judge people based on their behavior understand there is a higher order that exists outside the individual to which we all must be measured and ultimately will be judged. And that's fundamental. But it's very hard to see, sans a Christian reawakening, how we get back to that place. So I think it's going to be a step process. We'll explore this more with Mitchell tonight. But I think that's in part what he's saying, which is why he focuses on the hard work of apprenticeship knowledge from mediated institutions. And then he leaves open the question of that reawakening amid this awakening.
You've made the switch. And it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.